the headlines this hour. At least 18 people, including Ukraine's interior minister and his deputy, are killed in a helicopter crash outside of Kiev. Russia likens the recent actions of the U.S. to those of Adolf Hitler, saying Washington has also subjugated Europe in order to wage a war against Moscow. And nurses across England begin 2 days of strikes, joining a wave of industrial actions by UK public sector workers over the cost of living crisis. This is news. Thanks for joining us. A helicopter crash near a kindergarten and a residential building in the Ukrainian town of Brovary has left 18 people dead and 22 others injured. The National Police Chief says the country's interior minister, his deputy, and the state secretary of the ministry are among the dead. It was not immediately clear what caused the crash near the capital, Kiev. The Ukrainian presidency says the crashed helicopter was en route to the frontline regions in the east. President Volodymyr Zelensky has called the incident a terrible tragedy, and the prime minister has ordered an investigation into the crash. The governor of Kiev says children and staff of the nursery were evacuated after the incident. And staying with Ukraine, Russia and Ukrainian troops are continuing their fight on the eastern front line. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, joined us to give us the latest on the ongoing battle in Ukraine.
Well, this event, this helicopter crash, has made news, obviously, killing 18 people. But every day in the Donbass region, particularly around Bakhmut, many more than that, dozens, probably hundreds of soldiers have been killed or wounded every day in some of the most brutal fighting that we've seen so far. And this doesn't make the news on a daily basis because it's just part of daily life here in Ukraine. It is very much Russia moving forward at the moment. They recently captured Soledar. They're trying to attack Bakhmut. We might see a full withdrawal from the Ukrainians from Bakhmut soon, or they might continue fighting very hard. And Ukraine are putting up a very brave and stiff resistance. But it is Russia at the moment who we think are having more success on the front lines.
The Netherlands is planning to join the U.S. and Germany's efforts to arm Ukraine with advanced Patriot defense systems and to train its forces on how to use them. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte signaled his country's intentions in a meeting with the U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington. He had earlier also spoken to the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on the matter. Rutte said that his government is in talks about what exactly it can do or it can contribute to. Ukrainian soldiers are already in the U.S. to get training on the U.S. air defense system to repel Russian missile and drone attacks. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry says the training will last 10 weeks. Russia has warned against the deployment of the Patriot system to Ukraine, saying that it would be legitimate targets of the Russian military. Russia has reiterated its readiness to discuss the Ukraine conflict with Western countries and to respond to any serious proposals. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Moscow has yet to see any serious proposals for peace. He described the Ukrainian president's ideas on the matter as unacceptable, adding that any talks need to address Russia's wider security concerns. The top diplomat also compared the recent actions of the U.S. to those of Adolf Hitler and Napoleon Bonaparte. He underlined that Washington has subjugated Europe to its dictatorship in order to wage a war against Moscow. Speaking at a news conference, Lavrov once again called on NATO to remove its military infrastructure from Ukraine and other countries close to Russia's borders. The EU faces economic uncertainty in 2023 due to gas supply issues. The European Commission has acknowledged that energy sanctions against Russia are backfiring to some extent. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
On Monday, Eurozone finance ministers marked the occasion of Croatia becoming the 20th member of the Eurogroup. However, Zagreb joins the Euro at a very precarious time for the currency. The big question is, where will the EU get its gas in 2023 and at what price?
While high storage levels and lower demand have helped to bring energy prices down, the crisis is certainly not over.
The EU insists its move to cut out Russian energy over the war in Ukraine has damaged Moscow. But for the first time, there's an acknowledgement of collateral damage.
If you are cutting trade, if you are cutting imports, exports, the bilateral relations with the partner with whom you had a lot of to do with before, then of course there is some negative impact on our side.
Experts say the EU has always been overly dependent on imports of gas, oil and raw materials. It's a reality that won't change.
They all have to be imported in a way that other regions don't. And that means that the European Union is very vulnerable, and it also has to look very carefully where it makes geostrategic alliances.
To obtain essential supplies, the EU will turn a blind eye to crimes committed by the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, according to analysts. Despite enormous economic uncertainty at home, the EU is promising more financial aid for Ukraine.
We will continue to provide strong military, financial, diplomatic and political support to Ukraine and to the Ukrainian people. Together, the EU and its member states have contributed nearly 50 billion euros.
The European Commission has already organized 18 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023. The first tranche is currently being released. The EU will send a further 3 billion euro to Ukraine on Tuesday. As social inequality grows across the bloc, more and more people are asking, can we really afford to keep doing this? Jerome Hughes at the Eurogroup meeting, Brussels.
Nurses across England have started a two-day walkout over pay that could cause more disruption to the state-run health service. This is the second industrial action by nurses in 1 month. The main nursing union accuses the government of failing to take serious measures in improving wages. More such strikes are planned for February 6th and 7th by the Royal College of Nursing Union. Ambulance drivers and paramedics have also held their second walkout in 2 months. Public sector workers are angry over the country's rampant inflation that has outpaced their earnings. They are demanding better working conditions and an increase in their pay, in line with inflation that currently stands at nearly 11%. Food prices and energy bills have also soared in the UK due to stagflation. Australia has confirmed the purchase of military helicopters from the US to replace a fleet of French-made choppers, a move likely to spark frictions with Paris. Defense Minister Richard Marles said a deal has been finalized for 40 Black Hawk helicopters worth around $2 billion. The sale from the U.S. arms manufacturer Lockheed Martin Corporation was signed off by the State Department in August of last year. Taipan choppers, which Australia bought in 2007 from France's Airbus, have been plagued for years over maintenance issues. The announcement of replacing the fleet comes as France is set to deliver new helicopters this year. Marles has expressed confidence that the purchase of U.S. helicopters won't strain Canberra-Paris ties, but a 2021 Australian decision to ditch French-made submarines for U.S. and U.K.-made nuclear submarines sparked a bitter diplomatic row. Saudi Arabia has launched another deadly attack on Yemen despite ongoing diplomatic efforts to arrange a new ceasefire deal. The Saudi shelling of Sada'a province has left one civilian dead and two others injured. Our Sana'a correspondent Yusuf Mauri gave us the details.
Artillery shelling that's happening in North Yemen, in the province of Sada'a, this is something that's happening around the clock. And, you know, on my way here to the studio, we received more breaking news of another attack, which killed more people and injured more people, including an African migrant. You know, every day we're getting these reports of continuous artillery shelling happening in the north province of Sada'a. Every day we're getting reports of more civilians being killed by this artillery military campaign by the Saudi-led coalition in the north province of Sada'a. Of course, as you know, the north province of Sada'a is the Ansar Allah movement stronghold. That's where the Yemeni revolution started, and they've been bombarded the most by airstrikes since the war started in 2015. So it seems that the strategy for now by Saudi Arabia, it seems to be that although they've scaled down on their aerial attacks on Yemen, it seems that they have traded that for an intensifying the artillery shelling that's happening in the bordering region close to Saudi borders. And in actuality, these artillery shellings are killing more people than the Saudi airstrikes themselves. And this is something that's happening in the midst of continuous UN efforts to try to reach a peace resolution between the Yemeni government and the Saudi-led coalition. A couple of days ago, the Omani delegation, they left the country and they failed to reach any political solution between both sides of the conflict. And even with peace negotiations taking place for over the past 9 months, of course, in April, a ceasefire was declared and both sides, they were instructed to scale down their military offensive. The Saudi-led coalition has not done that.
A Saudi academic is on death row for using social media as the Al Saud regime is tightening its grip on dissidents. Prominent pro-reform law professor Awad Al-Karni was arrested in September 2017. The charges against them include owning a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to spread messages deemed hostile to the kingdom.
A prominent pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia is facing the death penalty for alleged crimes including having a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to share news considered hostile to the kingdom. The ruling against Awad al-Gharni, a pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia, was made public in a report published by The Guardian newspaper. Gharni's son, Nasser, who fled the kingdom last year and is living in the UK, shared the details of the charges brought against his father with the British Daily. Gharni, who was arrested in September 2017, was labeled in Saudi-controlled media as a dangerous preacher, but dissidents said the 65-year-old was an important and well-regarded intellectual with a strong social media following, including 2 million Twitter followers. Public prosecutors have called for the death penalty in the case, but the court has yet to make a formal judgment. The charges against Gharni, for which he is facing the death penalty, included the law professor's admission that he used a social media account under his own name and used it at every opportunity to express his opinions. The court documents also claim that Gharni admitted participating in a WhatsApp chat and was accused of participating in videos in which he praised Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Gharni's use of Telegram and creation of a Telegram account was also included in the allegations. Last year, Salma Al-Shahab, a Leeds PhD student and mother of two, received a 34-year sentence for having a Twitter account and for following and retweeting dissidents and activists. Another woman, Noura Al-Qahtani, was sentenced to 45 years in prison for using Twitter. The Saudi regime is also accused of ordering the 2018 brutal murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S.-Saudi citizen who used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi royalty. Khashoggi was dismembered during a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The ruling against the Saudi professor comes as human rights advocates and Saudi activists have warned that authorities in Riyadh are engaged in a severe crackdown on individuals who are perceived to be critics of the Saudi regime, as the use of social media and other communications have been criminalized inside the kingdom since the beginning of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reign in 2017.
Mohammed al-Gharni has been sentenced to death for using the social media to express his voice of dissent. That is while Riyadh and state-controlled investors have recently increased their financial stakes in American social media firms, including Twitter and Facebook. Those investments are aimed at projecting the kingdom as a hub of technology, modern infrastructure, sports, and entertainment in order to whitewash his checkered rights record.
The Saudi government and state-controlled investors have recently increased their financial stake in U.S. social media platforms, including Twitter and Facebook, and entertainment companies such as Disney. Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, a Saudi investor, is the second largest investor in Twitter after Elon Musk's takeover of the social media platform. The investor was himself detained for 83 days during a so-called anti-corruption purge in 2017. Prince Al-Walid has acknowledged that he was released after he had reached, quote, an understanding with the kingdom that was confidential and secret between me and the government. Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, the public investment fund, has separately increased its stake in Facebook and Meta, the company that owns Facebook and WhatsApp. Jeet Basuni, the head of Middle East and North African advocacy at Reprieve, the human rights group, said Al-Gharni's case fits into a trend the group has observed of scholars and academics facing the death penalty for tweeting and expressing their views. Asked about the kingdom's investment in Facebook and Twitter, Basuni said, if it wasn't so sinister, it would be farcical. It's consistent with how they are operating under this crown prince. Since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has arrested hundreds of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation of the crackdown. Muslim scholars have been executed and women's rights campaigners have been put behind bars and tortured as freedom of expression, association, and belief continue to be denied by the kingdom's authorities. Over the past years, Riyadh has also redefined its anti-terrorism laws to target activism.
Jordan has summoned Israel's ambassador after the regime forces prevented the Arab country's envoy from entering Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds. In a statement, the Jordanian Foreign Ministry said it handed the Israeli envoy a strongly worded letter of protest to be delivered immediately to the regime. In the letter, Jordan has underscored its official custodian status of Christian and Muslim holy places in Al-Quds, including Al-Aqsa. The ministry spokesman said that Israel, as an occupying power, must adhere to its obligations under international law toward the occupied city and its sanctities. Israeli forces on Tuesday blocked the Jordanian envoy's entry to the mosque and asked them to show permission. Israel's new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been stirring up tensions at Al-Aqsa. The regime forces regularly assault Palestinian worshippers and help settlers storm the mosque compound. Pakistani city of Karachi is hosting the second Iranian solo trade exhibition, displaying the country's diverse range of products and services. The event aims to enhance trade relations between the Islamic Republic and Pakistan. The political crisis deepens in Pakistan as Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province has dissolved its assembly just days after another province took a similar move. The governor of the northwestern province approved the dissolution. The assembly of Punjab, Pakistan's largest province, was dissolved on Saturday. As per the constitution, fresh elections for legislators must be held within 3 months. Both provinces were controlled by Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, a party led by former Prime Minister Imran Khan. Since his ouster in April last year through a no-confidence motion, Khan has run a series of campaigns and mass rallies to portray his dismissal as a foreign conspiracy. Last month, he announced that he would dissolve two of the country's four provincial assemblies in a bid to force early general elections. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Of course, the duties of men and women are different, but there is a balance. One of the women mentioned this in her talk in the same sense, and work has been done on this. This matter has been studied. You can find details on this in books, different writings, and such. When we look at responsibilities, emphasis is placed on the natural characteristics of men and women. There are certain differences between men and women, that is, in the female nature and in the male nature. There are differences in their bodies, souls, and in spiritual matters. Their duties are in accordance with these differences. These differences have an effect on the type of responsibilities assigned to men and women. This has to do with the feminine and masculine nature. Neither gender should act in a manner that contradicts their nature. A man who resembles a woman in his behavior, facial makeup, and other things, and a woman who resembles a man in her behavior, speech, and her movements are behaving improperly. They are both behaving improperly. This was about the personal duties and the different responsibilities that exist in the home and outside the environment of the home. Thank you.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As for duties in society, the responsibilities of men and women are the same. Their roles are different, but their duties are the same. Jihad is obligatory for both men and women, but the nature of jihad that men undertake is different from the jihad that is undertaken by women. For example, during the 8-year Holy Defense War, women also had obligations. They had duties, and they performed their duties well. During that period, women performed as well as men did, if not better. If you have not done so already, I suggest you read books about the roles of women during the period of Holy Defense. A number of books have been written about them. Praise God, our youth are concerned about these things and are producing such books now. Let's say you read one of the books that tells the story of one of the wives of the martyrs. I doubt you will be able to read one of these biographies without shedding tears while reading it. It is impossible.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister, Etmar Ben-Gvir, was ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gvir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely. Office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said a move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gvir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during a Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about, the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty, and in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade. The United States, and yet again, racially motivated killings happening on a record number. The tragic death of Keenan Darren Anderson after he was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident has sparked outrage. Anderson, 31, cousin of the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, died at a hospital in Santa Monica, California, after suffering a cardiac arrest following the crash on the afternoon of January 3rd in a Los Angeles neighborhood. Anderson was repeatedly tased by Los Angeles police officers and restrained following the accident. In a 13-minute body cam footage released by Los Angeles Police Department, Anderson is seen begging for help as multiple officers hold him to the ground and one officer presses his elbow along with his body weight onto his neck.
Stop it. Stop it, I'm going to tase you. Okay, stop it, I'm going to tase you. Stop it, I'm going to tase you.
Then Anderson can be heard. They're trying to George Floyd me, referring to African-American man George Floyd, who was killed at the hands of the U.S. police in May 2020 in Minneapolis, sparking racial justice protests around the world. In the footage, Anderson shouts, "They're trying to kill me," asking others for help. After the incident, paramedics arrived at the scene and took him to a hospital, where, according to the police, he went into cardiac arrest, which caused his death. Now, Patrice Cullors, who herself co-founded the Black Lives Matter movement, says her cousin was asking for help and he didn't receive it. She said he was killed, adding that nobody deserves to die in fear, panicking and scared for their life. Cullors noted her cousin was scared for his life, stressing that he spent the last 10 years witnessing a movement challenging the killing of black people. He knew what was at stake and he was trying to protect himself. Nobody was willing to protect him. Anderson's killing is the third such incident linked to the Los Angeles police in the first days of 2023. On January 2nd, police fatally shot 45-year-old Tucker Smith, and a day after, police fired on a 35-year-old Oscar Sanchez. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has called the incidents deeply disturbing, adding that we must reduce the use of force overall, and I have absolutely no tolerance for excessive force. The latest police violence highlights alarming proportions in the U.S. in recent years, with people of color being the main targets. A 2021 study recorded 30,800 deaths from the police violence across the U.S. between 1980 and 2018, far higher than estimates offered by the National Vital Statistics System. This study said more than 55 deaths of such incidents in the U.S. from 1980 to 2018 were misclassified or unreported in official vital statistics reports. Meanwhile, according to new data released earlier this month, U.S. police killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the country since experts first started tracking the killings. The killing of Keenan Darnell Anderson takes numerous matters into the spotlight. First and foremost is how U.S. officials reacted to the incident. 31-year-old father and English teacher, who is an African-American, killed by LAPD police. The cause, cardiac arrest after being repeatedly tased by the police. Anderson is the cousin of Black Lives Matter movement Patrice Cullors, but still no major word or reaction from anyone within the establishment. Two, could this death by any means be prevented? Cullors say this was a traffic accident. Instead of treating Anderson like a potential criminal, police could have called the ambulance. If there was a policy in which traffic stops were met with unarmed professionals who come to the scene to help with whatever situation has happened, that would have prevented my cousin's death, and that would have prevented so many other deaths. The other matter that has to be taken into account is how he was killed. One officer had his elbow on Anderson's neck while he was lying down before another tased him for roughly 30 seconds straight before pausing and tasing him again for 5 more seconds. The other point is LAPD not calling it a killing. It instead calls it an in-custody death. Apart from the ambiguity of the phrase, Keene was tased to death. Everyone knows LAPD caused Keenan's death. Cullors say these types of killing and this type of force will not be interrupted unless we have courageous elected officials come forward and challenge not just the police, but also the policies. One other factor is that the incident marks the third officer-involved death in the city this year. From 1980 to 2018, more than 30,000 people have died by police violence in the United States, according to a 22 article published in The Lancet. U.S. police killing 3 people in a day, and no progress since George Floyd. Based on figures released by Mapping Police Violence, police have killed roughly 1,100 people each year since 2013. In 2021, officers killed 1,136 people, one of the deadliest years on record. National data has shown that roughly 10% of the killings by police each year starts with a traffic encounter, and that 1 in 3 people killed were fleeing before lethal force was used. What about police brutality and racial bias? Why are there more cases of police brutality against African-Americans or people of color than whites? By one estimate, Black people are 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. In another study, black people who were fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Based on information from more than 2 million 911 calls in two U.S. cities, it can be concluded that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fire their guns five times as often as black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhoods. The Washington Post reports lawsuits to settle allegations of misconduct by more than 7,600 officers from around the country have amounted to more than $3.2 billion over the past decade. All in all, what seems to be a very high urgency is that U.S. police treatment of African Americans needs an overhaul. If not, more and more people like Keenan Darnell Anderson will fall victim to the U.S. police brutality, and officers involved killing will be sharply on the rise.
The Oxfam report analyzed 1,727 attacks on Yemeni civilians since the start of 2021. The report finds that at least 839 civilians were killed and 1,775 others were wounded during this time. 87 of the deaths were caused by airstrikes alone. The aircrafts used in the attacks, over half of them British-made, used cluster bombs, the use of which is banned by international law. The rest of the killings were done through artillery strikes, missile barrages, drone attacks, landmines, road bombs, and the use of light arms. According to another report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day on the war to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircrafts, Paveway bombs and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians. As stated by the International Development Committee of the UK, given that the UK has a long history of defense exports to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners, and considering the evidence we have heard, it seems inevitable that any violations of international humanitarian and human rights law by the coalition have involved arms supplied from the UK. These arms have also been used by the Saudi-led coalition to bomb health facilities on 19 separate instances, which constitutes war crimes. Oxfam's policy advisor Martin Butcher called on the UK government to immediately cease its arms sales to the Saudis. He also pointed out the hypocrisy of UK sanctions against Russia over alleged war crimes in Ukraine, all the while turning a blind eye to the blatant war crimes of the Saudi coalition in Yemen. Not only that, but he also pointed out to the fact that the UK government still continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, being its second biggest arms supplier, which will be inevitably used in the war against Yemen. Butcher also said they, the government, have really been not only arming Saudi Arabia, but also very reluctant to use their position in the Security Council to push for peace. Saudi Arabia is the biggest importer of arms in the world, second only to a country with 40 times the population. In the year 2020 alone, the kingdom imported nearly $1 billion worth of arms, the majority of which came from the U.S. This, however, does not stop the U.S. from parroting a tired narrative of pushing for peace in Yemen when they even hesitate to call it a war. This is apparent by Biden's initial pledges to end the war during his presidential campaign while still supplying arms to the kingdom to this day. Here's Timothy Lender King, U.S. Special Envoy to Yemen.
Let me begin first by reiterating our commitment, the commitment of the United States, to helping improve Yemeni lives, creating the space for Yemenis to collectively determine their own future, and to advance a durable resolution that ends the conflict in Yemen.
All the while, the weapon fragments bearing U.S. and U.K. branding paints a starkly different picture. The 6 months U.N.-sponsored truce that was supposed to be the grounds for longer-standing solutions was also very quickly and repeatedly violated by Saudi Arabia. This is what Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement sees as the reason for the temporary truce. The Saudi-led coalition's main goal out of the truce was to stop the Houthi Ansarullah forces from carrying out retaliatory military operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. Moreover, the crippling sea, land, and air blockade on Yemen has created a humanitarian disaster in the country. With all options exhausted, the Ansarullah movement has now said that it will inevitably launch missile strikes deep inside Saudi and UAE territories. This comes amid reports that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is looking to find a way out of the incredibly costly Yemen war. The Lebanese Al-Akhbar newspaper wrote, "Riyadh is now showing a lot of flexibility during negotiations. It currently has no concern other than getting security guarantees that strategic facilities deep inside the country would not be hit. It has abandoned the illusion of turning Yemen into a country under its tutelage and has instead sufficed for security assurances." However, this report needs more confirmation. While the Saudi coalition has indeed failed in its attempts to strangle Yemen into submission, their aggression still caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Since the war broke out in Ukraine and Western countries rushed to help Ukraine against Russia, they provided Ukraine with different types of weapons in a bid to prevent Russia's rapid military advance. But it has now turned out that the war has been a unique opportunity for Western arms manufacturers to make a profit. According to a report based on data from the Defense News and TradingView Analytics, major Western arms manufacturers involved in military supplies to Ukraine earned $124 billion last year. According to estimates, the corporation's combined market capitalization increased from $579 billion in December 2021 to $703 billion in December 2022. The ranking included 25 companies with a capitalization of over $1 billion, which are traded on the stock market and have military products dominating their revenues. These companies are actively involved in arms supplies to Ukraine. German arms manufacturer Rheinmetall has been the top gainer over the last 12 months. Its share price has surged 122%. Another notable example is French drone and missile producer Thales, whose stock value rose by 54%. American military contractor Northrop Grumman was up 44%, and the stock of HIMARS rocket launchers maker Lockheed Martin gained 42%. Other notable mentions in the report include BAE Systems, Kongsberg, Gruppen, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies.
Rather than continuing to build up offensive capability by transferring weapons from the American side to the Ukrainian side, which enriches American defense contractors and only allows more Ukrainians and more Russians to bleed, more and more weapons will eventually lead to an escalation of the war, and that is extremely dangerous.
The report comes amid increasing military support for Ukraine. In 2022, the Biden administration committed more than $19 billion in military aid to Ukraine. It's set to give Ukraine another $45 billion in 2023. Washington is now seeking to deliver Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The U.S. is now set to train scores of Ukrainian troops on how to deploy and maintain the American Patriot missile systems.
The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months. And once fielded, the Patriot will continue to contribute to Ukraine's air defense capabilities and provide another capability to the Ukrainian people to defend themselves against Russia's ongoing aerial assaults.
The Kremlin has said the systems and any crews accompanying them would be legitimate priority targets for the Russian military.
The U.S. is now contemplating delivering Stryker armored vehicles to Ukraine as part of a new Pentagon shipment. Furthermore, the U.K. announced that it would provide Ukraine with main battle tanks, and Poland said it would transfer a company of Leopard 2 Panzers to Kiev. Germany has, however, to greenlight Poland's re-export of the hardware. Germany says it will follow the U.S. President Joe Biden's lead on whether to support Kiev with Leopard 2 main battle tanks. Germany has faced mounting pressure to provide Ukraine with Leopard 2 tanks, but has been reluctant to do so. Russia has repeatedly warned Western countries against sending arms to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against flooding Ukraine with weapons. It insists that sending more weapons to Ukraine will only prolong the war, while prompting the Kiev forces to kill civilians in the pro-Moscow regions.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
IRIB
WIB English Radio.
Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. In the traditions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find this concept of the heart. Now, in many traditions, we find that the heart is considered the place where Allah resides. And we also find that the heart is the place where the love for Allah exists. Now, we find, again, in the traditions and in the Holy Quran in general, that we must protect this heart. And of course, when it comes to the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find this perfect heart, this heart which has reached a kamal, a perfection, a completion, a completeness, which leads towards ultimate perfection. Now, this heart, again, it must be protected. Imam Ali alayhi salam, when talking about this heart, he says that if despair, hopelessness, al-yas, overtakes the heart, successive regrets will kill it, and the anger of the heart will be intensified. And so here, dear brothers, we find that this is the truth, right? Well, one of the greatest sins, and of course in the book Greater Sins by Ayatollah Dastaghayb Shirazi, we find that he speaks about despair being one of the greater sins. Now, despairing in the mercy of Allah, despairing in the help of Allah, despairing in the victory of Allah. So in general, it means that we believe or we imagine that the troubles and tribulations and problems and hardships that we face in life are so great that even Allah either can't help us or He won't help us. And in both cases, we end up despairing from the help of Allah, the victory of Allah, the mercy of Allah, the forgiveness of Allah. Now, when this despair overtakes our heart, Imam Ali says, successive regrets will kill it, right? So the first step in this road towards destruction and ruin and depression and anguish and anger and frustration and regret and all these negative emotions, the first step is despair. We cannot save ourselves. Allah will not save us. Allah cannot save us. Allah will not forgive us. Allah will not find us a solution to our problems. And what happens is that then successive regrets come. Well, why didn't Allah help me? Allah should have helped me. This didn't happen. That didn't happen. This didn't get accomplished. That didn't get accomplished. This negative regret continuously, because it stems upon despair, starts to kill the heart. And eventually, the heart becomes so filled with despair and regret over the past and even perhaps the present that it is overwhelmed with anger, and anger is a constant companion for a human being. And it's not really a companion, more than a companion, it's a constant torment for a human being. For as it is also related in the traditions, the anger hurts
the individual themselves more than it hurts anybody else. And so, in order to protect this heart and make sure that it remains the abode of the Almighty Allah and that the love for Allah increases one way or the other, as Imam Ali says, do not let despair overtake your heart. Do not let successive regrets kill your heart. And of course, do not inflame and ruin your heart via anger. Another profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: قدر الرجل على قدر همته، وصدقه على قدر مروءته، وشجاعته على قدر أنفته، وعفته على قدر غيرته.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "The worth of a man is according to his courage. His truthfulness is according to his balance of temper. His valor is according to his self-respect. And his chasteness is according to his sense of shame."
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. We are talking to the Shias. Alhamdulillah, you know many, many examples. We are just highlighting some of these examples just to for ourselves to remember those examples and learn lessons in our own lives. When Ali was traveling from Medina to Basra with his army to deal with the rebels who had gathered in Basra, the Battle of Jamal. On the way, the army stopped in a place called Rabza. And there was a caravan probably going or coming back from Hajj, I'm not sure. But they were passing by and they came to know that this is the army of Amir al-Mu'mineen. So they diverted the route, went there, they said, we would like to see him. They were blessed. They had the opportunity to see Ali. When they came, you know, Abdullah ibn Abbas, the cousin of Ali, and a very close companion of the Imam,
He went to the tent of Imam to inform him that these people have come to see you. They would like to hear something from you. And Nahj al-Balagha has that statement from Ali when he talked to them. Even Sheikh Mufid in Kitab al-Irshad also mentions that. But it's interesting when Abdullah